طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is produced by Despina Mitsouris. This is your host, John Roberts. We begin this morning with an update on some of the boycott movements we have been following throughout the country and, in fact, throughout the world. First is the story of Stephen Salada, who left a tenured position at the University of West Virginia to accept a tenured professorship at the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. His wife also left a tenured position. The couple moved to Champaign, bought a house, and were prepared to teach this fall semester. But Stephen was suddenly fired before the semester even began for making, quote, uncivil remarks, unquote, concerning Israel's bombing of Gaza. An uproar has ensued, but the University of Illinois has not reneged. Now comes a report that 34 administrators at the University of Illinois have written to the school's incoming president stating that the firing of Salada last summer for speaking his mind on Twitter about Israel's assault on Gaza has crippled their efforts to recruit top-level scholars. That 34 heads of departments and units are now signed on in opposition to the university's handling of the case is also a big development. Back in the summer, it seemed as if they were hovering at about 15 or so departments. Clearly, far from diminishing, the controversy on campus has only expanded. What's even more amazing is where it has expanded. Three of the signatories are chairs of the departments of chemistry, math, and statistics. The opposition has spilled beyond the walls of the humanities and social sciences. The administrator's letter appeared on the Academy blog as an open letter from department heads at the University of Illinois to incoming President Timothy Killeen about the Salada case. The Department of History has already abandoned a previously authorized senior search in U.S. history this year in recognition of the bleak prospects of attracting suitable applicants in the current climate, they report. And we cannot hope to recruit excellent senior faculty because candidates cannot trust the school to honor principles of free speech. The most important thing about this letter is that these officials are uncowed by the Israel lobby. They are standing up for Salada, defying any risk, another sign of the changing climate in the United States. The letter begins, "The recent words and actions of senior officials in connection with the decision to revoke an offer of a tenured position in American Indian Studies to Dr. Stephen Salada have done genuine damage to the university, and especially to the Urbana-Champaign campus. That remains largely unrecognized outside of the affected units. The program in American Indian Studies has itself obviously suffered the most as a result of the administration's actions, but the harm to other units is also significant and ongoing. Representatives of the American Anthropological Association, the American Comparative Literature Association, the American Historical Association, the American Philosophical Association, the American Sociological Association, the American Studies Association, and the Modern Languages Association, among others, have issued strongly worded statements or letters critical of the university. More than 5,000 academics from across the country and around the world have expressed their disapproval by boycotting UIUC. More than 36 scheduled talks and multiple conferences across a variety of disciplines, including, for example, this year's entire colloquium series on the Department of Philosophy, have already been canceled, and more continue to be canceled as outside speakers have withdrawn in response to the university's handling of Dr. Salata's case. The Department of English decided to postpone a program review originally scheduled for spring 2015 in anticipation of being unable to find qualified external examiners willing to come to campus. Tenure and promotion cases may be affected as faculty at peer institutions consider extending the boycott to recommendation letters. Most troubling of all, the ability of many departments to successfully conduct faculty searches, especially at the senior level, has been seriously jeopardized. While the possible negative effects on even junior searches remain to be seen, the Department of History has already abandoned a previously authorized senior search in U.S. history this year in recognition of the bleak prospects of attracting suitable applicants in the current climate. An open-ranked search in philosophy attracted 80% fewer applicants at the rank of associate or full professor than a senior search in the same area of specialization just last year. We have long been proud of the University of Illinois' ability to maintain and extend its excellence through the recruitment of the very best scholars in the world. In many disciplines, however, we cannot hope to recruit excellent senior faculty to this campus or to retain many of those already here when they can no longer trust that this university will honor the principles of decision-making, free speech, and the freedom to conduct research. The department heads specifically deplore the statement of Chancellor Phyllis Wise, the school's CEO, that the school will not tolerate disrespectful words or actions that demean and abuse either viewpoints themselves or those who express them. Followed by the Board of Trustees' declaration that there is no place in a democracy for speech that does not promote civility. What a standard. The administrators also criticized the hasty manner in which Chancellor Wise upended a months-long process of selecting Salata in a few days in July and August as Israel conducted its onslaught on Gaza. As Salata expressed rage over the actions, Wise was meeting with alarmed fundraisers at the school, which is the bottom line in most of these censorship issues on American campuses. The big donors complain, academic institutions fold. It's a very sad story. In a related story, in Washington, D.C. recently, the American Anthropological Association's annual business meeting was packed with more members than any other time in recent memory, over 700. The meeting room was so crowded that hotel staff had to take down a wall with the adjoining room to accommodate everyone. On the agenda was a proposed resolution against boycotting Israel academic institutions. This effort to shut down the boycott discussion backfired spectacularly. Members present overwhelmingly voted down the measure, which mustered a mere 52 supporters. The atmosphere of the room was electric as anthropologists from across the profession discussed the boycott on the ongoing violations of Palestinian academic freedom and human rights. Of the 24 members who spoke, three-quarters opposed the resolution, arguing that it was an attempt to shut down a crucial debate. In recent months, over 1,000 anthropologists have signed a boycott pledge to protest Israel's ongoing, systematic, and widespread violation of Palestinians' academic freedom and human rights. Anthropologists campaigning for the boycott elected not to pursue a resolution at this year's AAA meeting in favor of building the broadest possible support among members over the coming months. They sponsored a series of panels at the conference to raise awareness about the boycott and about human rights violations in Palestine. Despite this, opponents of the boycott sought to short-circuit the debate by forcing the AAA to take an anti-boycott position now. After the resolution was presented, Lisa Rofel of the University of California, Santa Cruz, reminded members that the discussion about boycotting Israeli academic institutions within AAA has only just begun and should not be shut down. Rofel also criticized the resolution's false claim that the boycott seeks to harm Israeli scholars. She reminded colleagues that the boycott does not apply to individuals and pointed to the model of the ongoing boycott against the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign for the firing of Stephen Salata. Rofel explained, "Scholars who were invited to give talks at UIUC have canceled talks and will not do business with the institution. However, we all have been encouraged to invite faculty from UIUC to our own campus. That's what a boycott looks like." Under the boycott, Israelis would still be permitted to participate in AAA meetings and publish in its journals. Serena Grewald of Yale University reminded the audience that the American Studies Association's support for the boycott did not prevent numerous Israelis from attending that group's recent annual meeting. Anthropologists specializing in Israel-Palestine, who spoke at the meeting, overwhelmingly endorsed the boycott and opposed the resolution. Ilana Feldman of George Washington University said that 25 years of working in Israel-Palestine gives me the information I need to know that boycott is the right action we need to take to stand in support of Palestinians. Several members debunked the myth that a boycott would undermine efforts to change Israel from within. Nancy Shepherd Hughes of UC Berkeley cited recent conversations with Israeli dissidents that persuaded her to reject the resolution. An Israeli graduate student also took to the microphone, arguing that conversations do not take place in a void, but are embroiled in power. Boycott is not ending the conversation, but changing the terms of it. Other graduate students also spoke out against the resolution, reflecting the widespread support of the boycott in AAA's newer generation. One said, "I oppose this resolution as a Jew and because during my Passover years growing up, we used to say that our liberation will not be complete until everyone's is." Rima Hamami from Be'erzeit University in Palestine announced that she was thrilled to finally be at an academic conference where the problems faced by Palestinians have been centrally discussed. Hamami reminded her American colleagues that the United States is deeply implicated in enabling Israel's actions through military, diplomatic, and financial aid. Hamami also expressed regret that aside from the actions of a few courageous individuals, Israeli academic institutions had shown no solidarity with Palestinian colleagues, even when universities like Be'erzeit were effectively strangled by Israeli army checkpoints. About a quarter of the speakers at the meeting supported the resolution, often repeating its false claim that the boycott applies to Israeli scholars as individuals. Sergi Khan of Dartmouth College insinuated that support for the boycott is anti-Semitic because it suggests that AAA has a Jewish problem, drawing groans from the audience. AAA members present rejected the resolution by acclamation, with only 52 of the over 700 present voting in support. The room erupted into applause and cheers. Finally, an update on a BDS movement that is taking off across the country, focused on the real estate giant REMAX. While temperatures cooled, the first week of December saw a tremendous kindling of the boycott, sanctions, and divestment BDS movement, as Palestinian solidarity activists across the United States flooded REMAX offices, demanding that the real estate giant cease its activities in illegal Jewish-only settlements in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem. REMAX is one of the largest real estate corporations in the world. REMAX International, based in the United States with headquarters in Denver, Colorado, oversees more than 100,000 agents in over 7,000 offices in almost 100 countries. Several of REMAX's Israeli franchises sell property in illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem. The office of REMAX, Israel's franchise, is itself located in Ma'al Adumim, a major illegal settlement in the occupied West Bank. REMAX Israeli agents openly admit that many of the homes they sell can only be owned by Jewish people. The United Nations published a report in 2013 indicating that REMAX U.S. can be held accountable for the crimes of REMAX Israel, over which it has constant interaction and influence. Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, that the occupying power shall not deport or transfer parts of its own civilian population into the territory it occupies, and UN Security Council Resolution 446 explicitly states that Israel's settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories in which REMAX Israel is operating have no legal validity. On Saturday, November 29th, three boycott REMAX demonstrations were held thousands of miles apart. Activists from a variety of groups, including Code Pink, Veterans for Peace, Jewish Voice for Peace, and more, gathered in Dallas, Texas, Strongsville, Ohio, and Somerville, Massachusetts, to protest outside of REMAX offices. Those in Strongsville and Somerville stood outside for hours in below-freezing weather. On Tuesday, December 2nd, activists from Code Pink, Greater Boston, the Boston Coalition for Palestinian Rights, United for Justice with Peace, Jewish Voice for Peace Boston, and more held a demonstration outside a REMAX office in Boston. Organizer Hayat Imam said she salutes Code Pink for putting out the call for actions against REMAX to demand that they stop the sale of houses on stolen Palestinian land by their franchisee, REMAX Israel, and feels good about the fact that our action is the opening salvo of the boycott in Boston. Imam explains that activists made an appointment with REMAX and organized a representative delegation of individuals who had just been to Palestine so they could talk about the first-hand conditions there and to hand a letter to the REMAX chair. And so the BDS movement continues to build momentum. We will continue to cover the movement because it is proving to be the most effective form of resistance to the Israeli occupation and has really caused great consternation to the government of Israel. The focus of our feature presentation this week is the children of Palestine, who really suffer terribly under this Israeli occupation. The stories of children being arrested in the middle of the night, pulled from their beds and detained for such minor offenses as throwing stones, are legion. Ivan Karakasian from the organization Defense for Children International Palestine delivered this poignant speech on the plight of Palestinian children at the Tree of Life conference held in Cambridge in November. The presentation included a PowerPoint presentation, but Ivan narrates through the PowerPoint visuals so that his address is applicable for radio. Here is Ivan Karakasian.
First of all, thank you, friends of Sibiu, North America, and Tree of Life for inviting me to speak to you guys. I'm a Palestinian, born and raised in Jerusalem, and currently I work for the advocacy, I lead all advocacy and communications efforts at Defense for Children International Palestine, which is actually the only local independent Palestinian child rights organization currently operating in the West Bank. And what my talk will really be about today is just the situation about children, what's going on in the West Bank, and what we face and the challenges we face in trying to get justice for these children. I went to journalism school, and in journalism school, my professors always used to say, show, don't tell, show, don't tell. So what I'm going to try and attempt to do throughout this presentation is actually show you short videos, and some of those short videos I'll narrate alongside them. But the first video is actually, just to get things started, is actually of an ordinary 13-year-old girl who dreams of becoming a famous Palestinian rapper. But this ordinary 13-year-old Palestinian girl lives in the neighborhood of Sidwan in Jerusalem, where a handful of Israeli settlers moved in there, making life very difficult for the predominantly Palestinian Arab neighborhood. And so what we find with this child is that she's growing up in a hyper-militarized environment. And I'll have her tell you her story. So as I was saying, I grew up in Jerusalem, and what you see, what's happening to this girl is not new. This has been the case, not for the last year, not for the last 5 years. It's been going on for decades. I've been witnessing violations of children's rights my entire life. And part of what we do at Defense for Children International Palestine is we really try to pursue justice for these kids and protections for these kids. And the reason it's important in our context to try and get justice for these kids is many of them, because they live in this hyper-militarized environment, are constantly being traumatized and re-traumatized, and they've lost any sense of safety in their home. So the only way we can try and restore that, restore some of their human security and dignity, is by trying to get justice for them. And of course, we pursue protections because we're trying to prevent their rights from being further violated. It's extremely challenging work because we work in a culture of complete impunity, where there's a lack of accountability for any wrongdoing against children. And so now, I'm just going to go in briefly about the legal systems in the West Bank, bear with me. In the West Bank, since 1967, everyone living in the West Bank, man, woman, and child, has been under military rule, military law. That only applies to the Palestinians living in the West Bank. All Israeli Jewish settlers living in the same territory in the occupied West Bank have Israeli civilian law applied to them. And that has real consequences. So to give a brief example, under military law, there are a wide set of security offenses. One of these security offenses is throwing stones. So the mere act of throwing a stone is a security offense under the Israeli military legal system. 60% of Palestinian children are charged with throwing stones. The offense of throwing stones does not exist under the Israeli civilian legal system. So if an Israeli child throws a stone, he's done nothing wrong. If he breaks a window, he's charged under perhaps vandalism laws, but he's not charged for the mere act of picking up a stone and throwing it. If a Palestinian child picks up a stone and throws it at the separation barrier, the concrete wall that is the separation barrier, and nothing happens to the wall, because what could a stone do to the concrete wall? He could potentially face a maximum sentence of 10 years. If a child picks up a stone and throws it at a moving military jeep, he could potentially face a maximum sentence of 20 years. Now, these sentences are seldom applied, but what they quickly show you is that the military system, even though it's a legal system, and you hear the court system, and people think when we're talking about legal systems and court systems, that we're talking about justice. What we're really talking about here is a system of control, of trying to control the entire population of the West Bank. And when you see these offenses and the sentences they potentially carry, that quickly becomes evident. One of my favorite security offenses also is insulting the honor of a soldier. Insulting the honor of a soldier, which carries a sentence of 1 year, and it's not very well defined, so a child doesn't really know if he's insulted the honor of a soldier or not. And then what I wanted to discuss is, well, what happens if a child is caught throwing stone? What's the arrest process like? Who here knows their Miranda rights, their Miranda warnings? Good, yeah, I would say I learned them from Law and Order, so I memorized them. But anyway, I'll run through them very quickly. It's the right to remain silent, the right to consult an attorney prior to an interrogation, the right to have an attorney present during interrogation. If you can't afford an attorney, one will be appointed to you. And most importantly from these rights is when the officer says, have you understood these rights as I've read them to you? All of these rights do not exist for Palestinian children when they're arrested, with the exception of the right to remain silent, which Israeli soldiers and the arresting officers rarely inform the children about. So these children don't know their rights. The vast majority of these children are arrested between the hours of midnight and 5 a.m. in the morning. So if you could imagine being a parent and you know, you've watched a late show, the kids are already sleeping, you're going up to the bedroom, you're about to doze off, and you get this loud knocking on the front door. And you go down and it's a police officer, and the police officer says, we're here to arrest your child. You would say, you know, well, do you have a warrant, officer? Something along these lines. What has my kid done? You would certainly not expect the police officer to then raid the house, go upstairs, and wake up the children. Well, in the Palestinian context, that's exactly what happens. In the Palestinian context, between midnight and 5 a.m., a unit of soldiers, roughly 14, sometimes as many as 18 soldiers, will raid the home. The minute the father opens the door, they'll go into every bedroom, they'll have a photo of the child and the child's ID number, and they'll just start looking for him. The child often wakes up in his bedroom to find several soldiers standing with their M16 pointed at him, and that's how he wakes up. And if you can imagine being a 12 or 13 or 14-year-old child, and frankly, an adult, waking up in your bedroom to find a unit of soldiers aiming their weapons at you, it's extremely traumatic. At that point, you realize both your home is not safe, your home is not secure, and your bedroom doesn't offer any type of privacy. They put on plastic ties on his hands, and then he's quickly blindfolded and taken out of the home. The parents don't know why the child's being arrested. They're not presented with an arrest warrant, they have no idea why the soldiers have come in to arrest their child, and they also don't know where their child is being taken. So effectively, and depending on the age of the child, a child can disappear for anywhere between 24 to 96 hours, where no one knows what's happening to that child. And rather than simply just talk you through what happens during the arrest process and what I've described, recently Beit Tselem, which is the Israeli human rights groups, has a great program where they've given a lot of cameras to volunteers. And one of the volunteers last week caught the arrest of an 11-year-old child with mental impairment. This was done at the Kiryat Arba settlement, just on the outskirts of the West Bank city of Hebron. And just to be clear, under Israel's own laws, the age of criminal responsibility is 12. So if you're under 12, they can't arrest you no matter what you've done. But here we see them violating their own laws and arresting an 11-year-old child. And I'd like to play the video for you. What's interesting here is that the settlers are cheering for the soldiers to arrest this child. They're being excited at the arrest of an 11-year-old mentally impaired child. You'll now see the soldiers walk the child to the Israeli military chief. There they are. You can barely see the child. And look how far they're twisting his arm. You know, so often you hear in this context that the Israeli soldiers are just children and in conflict with other children. But this is what an Israeli soldier looks like, and that's what a child looks like. And I just like to draw that contrast. They're trying to put on a single plastic board, which is also in violation of the Israeli military laws, because they say you're supposed to use 3 plastic boards with the middle one tying the other 2, but so often they'll use a single one, and when our lawyers catch up with them, they'll find bruising on their wrists. Here, residents from the village are trying to tell the soldiers that the child is both 11 years old and mentally impaired, but the soldier is having none of it. There's nothing the residents can do to help this child. And then notice the blindfolds are on, and then the child was sat on the metal floor of the Jeep. He wasn't sat on the benches of the Jeep. And then he's shut off. And then now you'll see a woman trying to come to his aid, and then the soldier sort of aims his gun at her. Really, the parents feel very helpless to help their children in these situations. So what happens once the child is in the military jeep this way? Usually, and remember, we're talking about 13, 14. In fact, Defense for Children International Palestine goes according to international law, and anyone under the age of 18 is a child. So most of the people we're dealing with are between the ages of 12 and under the age of 18. So if you can imagine being a child, blindfolded, hands tied, you're sat on the metal floor of an Israeli military jeep, and then the soldiers come and sit on the benches on either side. And they're ready to transfer you to a military base. And that's when the verbal and physical abuse begins. And we've had even cases, we've recorded incidents where there was an empty beer bottle in the military jeep that the soldiers used to smash on the head of the child. We've had situations where the soldiers were smoking and extinguished their cigarettes on the arms and lips of children. We've had them, you know, they always rough up the children. In fact, according to our documentation, 75% of children arrested go through some form of physical violence during the arrest, transfer, and interrogation period. The child is then transferred to a military base, but because it's so early, usually in the morning, the interrogators aren't ready to show up to work. So the child has to wait until the following morning when the interrogator is ready to go to work. And usually the child is kept in the military base, either outside in the field, whatever the weather conditions may be, or in a room. And on occasion, and just for kicks, the soldiers let into that room a military dog. And Palestinian children particularly are really afraid of dogs. And if a child asks for food, water, or access to a toilet, he could expect further physical and verbal abuse. So he's denied food, water, and access to a toilet, sometimes for up to 10, 12 hours. And usually because the children are rushed out of their homes so quickly, they're never wearing appropriate clothing. You know, if it's winter, they don't have their winter coats on while they're sat outside for 10 hours. Finally, the child, having gone through that abuse, through that trauma, feeling completely alone because his parents don't know where he is really primed to give a confession to the interrogator. These are really professional interrogators, and sometimes there's more than one of them. Sometimes there's up to 5 sometimes interrogating a single child. And what happens to the child is he's sat in a chair far smaller than this one, He's shackled to that chair, so he's feeling extremely vulnerable, and that's when the interrogators begin screaming and shouting at him to intimidate him so that he could confess more quickly. If he doesn't confess at that point, then they'll start the physical violence. The physical violence may involve a phone book, may involve a baton, whatever is handy to hit the child with. And then if that doesn't work, what's been more concerning is the use of solitary confinement on children. Usually here in the U.S., solitary confinement is used as punishment during the sentence of a child. So the child is already convicted, and if he does something, the warden might give him solitary confinement as punishment. Or sometimes a child in the U.S. is placed in solitary confinement to separate him from the adult population. In this context, in the Israeli military context, the child is put in solitary confinement before he's charged with anything as a means to extract a coerced confession. And according to the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, if an adult spends 2 days in solitary confinement, that's tantamount to torture. We've had children as young as 16 spend 28 days or 29 days in this condition. And just to be clear what the conditions are like, it's a 2x4 room, extremely tiny. There are no windows, so the child has no idea if it's day or night. There are protrusions from the wall so that the child can't lean up and rest against the wall. There's only a thin mattress on the floor, and it's really dirty, and they force the child to sit on it. There's a dim yellow lit light that stays on 24 hours a day, and there's an open slit near the ceiling that lets in cold air. And the only thing that the child sees is when the flap opens in the door and the food is brought in, much of it inedible for the children. The only human contact the child has is when he's taken back out to see to meet his interrogator. And at that point, because that's the only form of human contact the child has in days on end, the child is ready to say whatever just to stay in that interrogation room and have that human contact. And in the vast majority of cases, children end up confessing whether they did something or they didn't do anything. And that confession, which, by the way, in 20% of the cases is typed up in Hebrew, a language most children don't understand, so often the children are made to sign a document and they have no idea what they just signed. That statement, that confession, is used as the single piece of strongest evidence to convict that child. Here in the U.S., that kind of coerced confession would be thrown out. In the Israeli military court system, it's relied upon. That, along with the statement of the military officer. And because it's a military system, no one ever questions the statement of the military officer. Of course, he's always telling the truth. I often ask our lawyers, you know, how do you practice law when the file is so thin? It has this coerced confession, and it has the statement of the military officer, and that's all you're given. And our lawyers tell me that they don't practice law. What they practice is negotiation. They end up negotiating the best possible plea bargain with the military prosecutor that they can to get the child out of the system as quickly as possible. The reason we go for plea bargains, in fact, very few children sit through a trial, is because the trial process can take up to a year and a half. And because the children are denied bail in over 90% of the cases, that child will remain in prison for that year and a half duration. Whereas if he pleads guilty, you know, the maximum sentence he's likely to get is 5 months. Which is a lot shorter than the year and a half. So most children plead guilty because it's a faster route out of the system. That shows that the system is not interested in justice, and that's why I think in 2011 there was the military court system had something like a 96% or 97% conviction rate, which is extremely high. Basically, everyone gets convicted. So, and Israel actually is the only country currently that automatically and systematically detains, prosecutes, and convicts up to 700 children every single year. If that doesn't happen to the children, if they don't go through the Israeli military detention system, then oftentimes when they join peaceful marches or demonstrations or whenever they try to resist the occupation in any way, The Israeli forces quickly clamped down on them and have been increasingly using excessive use of force. They use what they call non-lethal crowd control weapons, but these non-lethal crowd control weapons have led to paralysis, have led to children being shot in the face and the eyes and therefore becoming permanently blind. We've even had one child shot with a tear gas canister that blew his nose right off. And the part of the reason for that is because the Israeli military isn't abiding by their own open fire regulations. The open fire regulations say that these weapons, for example, a tear gas canister, should be shot into an open space. Instead, a lot of times Israeli soldiers use the tear gas canisters to shoot directly at the children, at the people, at the demonstration. Similarly, with rubber bullets, they're supposed to shoot them below the waist, but we've recorded incident after incident where they're shot above the waist. Worse still is when the Israeli military uses live ammunition. Under the Israeli military's own open fire regulations, they're only supposed to use live ammunition in cases of real mortal danger to their lives. So often, they'll use live ammunition when they're clearly not in danger. On May 15th of this year, while Palestinians were commemorating Nakba Day, the day that the Palestinians were dispossessed of their land in 1948, clashes erupted in Bitunia, the West Bank, just outside Ofer military prison, between Palestinian youth and Israeli soldiers. And in those clashes, during the lull in the fighting, Israeli soldiers shot and killed two Palestinian teens, one 16 years old and one 17 years old. We were lucky because the clashes took place outside a storefront that had CCTV footage. And I would like to show you the incidents when these children were shot. And you know, viewer discretion advised. I know you're all stuck here, but bear with me. That's tough footage. Yeah. See, there are clashes taking place, except as you can see, the soldiers aren't nearby, so there was no real mortal danger to the lives of these soldiers. It's this guy's cameras that caught the incident. Notice this child that's coming into the screen now. There he goes. He's just been shot. And people rushed to his aid. There were a lot of international media that day, which really helped us, and I'll tell you why in a moment. As you can see right there, that's a lull in the clashes. There's no active violence, and there's no threat to the soldiers that are really out of view. Notice this child walking with his back turned to the soldiers. He was just shot in the back. He was clearly not causing any real mortal danger to the soldiers when he was shot in the back. When we released this footage, the Israeli military quickly tried to say that we fabricated this footage. They looked at the timestamp and then said the shadowing was off, and something that we played with what's happened. And then they questioned the way the children fell and said, is it natural for children to fall that way? And then they tried to say someone else tried to shoot these kids. And we said, but there were no guns. Obviously, why wouldn't you shoot the people with the guns and shoot these people instead? Luckily for us, like I said, there was a lot of international media. And among that international media was CNN. And CNN had also caught some footage, and they released it about 3 days after we'd released our footage. And in that footage, what you see is, you see, they captured the soldiers. And one of the soldiers they captured was an Israeli military spokesperson. He was there simply to cover the clashes, not to partake in any of the shooting. But he was so bored during the clashes that he asked his commanding officer for his assault rifle to just take shots for fun at these children. And so the commanding officer gave him his gun, and that spokesperson just started shooting at the children for fun. When the video was released, the military couldn't deny that that's what was taking place, that that person had no right whatsoever to be shooting. So they sentenced him. And do you know what they sentenced him to? They sentenced him to a one-month suspended sentence. And then he was restored to full active duty. And that's the problem that we face. That's the lack of accountability. And that's the challenge. And that impunity is what allows these soldiers to carry out these actions. And this brings me to the final part of my talk, which is what took place in Gaza this summer. This summer, in the 51 This summer, in 51 days, on average, each day, 10 children were killed. So the UN says 501 children. We, our field workers, were struggling with these numbers. And sometimes we're counting one person as three people. And we said, well, what's going on? How come you're counting these people multiple times? And they came back and they said, well, because different, some of us go to different hospitals, and they find different body parts of the same child. And so trying to reassemble these children to know just how many children have been killed took us a while. And so far we've confirmed 480 children killed. Worse than the children killed are the children that have been traumatized in Gaza. 373,000 children now require psychosocial support. And that doesn't even include all the children that have already been traumatized by the three previous offensives. In fact, in Gaza, if you're 8 years old or older, this is your fourth military offensive that you've lived through. And Muhammad Abu Jami'ah from the Abu Jami'ah family survived the three previous assaults, and he was 8 years old this summer, and he died. He died along with 18 other children from the same family in a single strike on that family's apartment building. So one thing that Defense for Children International Palestine is doing is we realized there was going to be a UN commission of inquiry that was going to look into the alleged war crimes that took place in Gaza, both by Palestinian armed groups and by the Israeli military. The US government is against this UN commission of inquiry. They're worried it's just going to point the finger at Israel. And as such, we can't get to the facts. And now Israel's trying to say, the human rights groups are exaggerating. It's not true. And when we try to send a commission there to get to the facts, it's being denied and it's not being cooperated with. So one thing we did is we set up a petition to show that the American people don't agree with their government and want the UN Commission of Inquiry to get to the results, to find out what's going on. And that's the thing. Part of the reason I come and talk in the U.S., is because you folks bear a responsibility. And the reason you bear a responsibility is because Israel supplies $3.1 billion of your tax dollars to buy for military equipment in Israel. Some of the weapons used in Gaza were U.S. weapons. And my colleague Sahar will speak more about this, but there's actually a federal law in the U.S. that says the U.S. cannot sell weapons to a country that will then go on to use them for human rights violations. Whatever we think might have taken place in Gaza, there were clear human rights violations that will show that these representatives, when they voted in this federal law, are just simply not applying it. And so we ask you to ask your representatives to uphold the laws that they're enforcing, that they're voting in here in the U.S. Thank you.
That was Ivan Karakasian of the Defense for Children International Palestine speaking at the Tree of Life Conference in Cambridge last November. And that is all the time we have this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live at www.wzbc.org or listen to us at any time via the WZBC archive found on the WZBC homepage. Thanks for listening. We hope you'll join us again next Sunday. And you are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.